Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Rudolf Buchbinder. He performs Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Kimmel Center this evening. Susan Lewis visits the Clay Studio in Philadelphia. We speak with Nina Jablonski. She'll discuss her research into human skin and a free lecture at the Wagner Free Institute of Science this afternoon. And Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns profiles mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato back in Philadelphia for a weekend recital. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Pianist Rudolf Buchbinder's lifelong passion has been a meticulous study of musical sources. Of particular interest is the piano music of Ludwig van Beethoven, whose scores he has collected in numerous editions. Buchbinder has even performed and conducted all of Beethoven's piano concertos over two concerts in one day in Vienna in 2003. Tonight he performs Beethoven's fourth piano concerto in the last of a series of concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I spoke with Rudolf Buchbinder earlier this week. In reading and researching for this interview, I was very struck by your dedication to the note on the page and what you've done to pursue the authentic note on the page. What sent you down this track?
You know, it started slowly. These kind of things never come overnight. It started slowly when I got my first facsimile of a Beethoven sonata, and then I start to realize how much you discover from this facsimile. And so I started to collect all over the world, first editions and facsimile, and, you know, I can't believe it, but actually from all the pieces I play, and this is a lot, my repertoire is quite huge, you know, I have most from them, I have the first edition or a facsimile.
And what does that lend to your playing? Is there a sense of security that you know that this is what the composer intended?
First of all, a fingering by any strange pianist or any teacher has nothing to do with the original score of Beethoven, Mozart or Schubert or anyone. And you know, when I study a Beethoven sonata, I'm very lucky to have 18 different editions of the Beethoven sonatas. And so if I study one sonata, different editions are lying on the piano and I'm comparing one with the other. For instance, one edition I find it's wonderful edition, it's by Franz Liszt. Franz Liszt was a great admirer of Beethoven, and you know he was not a bad pianist, as we know. There's not one fingering of Franz Liszt in this score. Just we do it today. Why?
You asked the question, but there is a lot of emphasis today on the interpretation, yeah. That younger pianists are a lot of the time told that, yes, what's on the page is important, but they're putting their own personality into it is more important, and it's become more emphasized, I think, over recent years.
I think the artist, the student, the pianist, whoever plays the sonata, he has to find his own way to this piece, not the editor. And that's the point. You have to make a decision between edition. I mean, there are some old editions by Alfred Cortot or by Arthur Schnabel, where it's just one line of music on the page and the rest is texture, you know, explaining how it should be played and so on. Who cares about that?
Which, to an extent, is casting the musician in the role of almost a historian or as a historic actor, that they have to learn the context from the notes in the score.
Yes, they have to learn it by themselves. There's one exception, of course. There's a marvelous book of Karl Czerny about the interpretation of Beethoven's works. And, you know, you discover so many new things. You must imagine that Karl Czerny was able to play the whole music, what Beethoven wrote, even the string quartets, chamber music, by heart.
A lesson you've taken very much to heart, performing all five Beethoven.
Oh, yeah.
In one day, yeah. And not merely for an audience, but have recorded it as well. Tell us about the process of taking in that amount of music to reproduce it over two concerts.
First of all, it was not my idea. It was from the director of the concerthaus. He said to me, Rudy, what do you think about the idea to play all five Beethoven concerti one day? I said, wow, this is a hard job. But when you think some of my colleagues are practicing 6 hours a day, it is much worse. I never practiced in my life 6 hours a day. So I agreed, and we made one concert at 11 o'clock in the morning and the second at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And this was recorded from the radio. And then the radio asked me, you know, Rudy, this is such a fantastic recording. Are we able to make a CD out of that? Then I said, of course, I have to control it. What I hate, because I never listen to my own recordings. Never.
Oh.
Never.
Not even for the editing process, no, before
no,
it's
no,
released?
No. It's finished.
But do you always have a sense of when it's good?
I mean, oh, yes. Yes.
How much of an effort was it for you to recall all of this music?
Well, I was counting a few days ago. How many piano concerti, if one asks me, can you play this tomorrow? How many piano concerti these are? These are 30.
My goodness.
So I can play 30 piano concerti immediately out of my 50 concerti, which I'm a repertoire. So 20 concerti are not in one day, then I need perhaps a few more days.
In view of these collections of scores that you have, in view of the very long relationship you've had now with the composer, who is Beethoven for you now, as a man?
You know, the image, what people try to put into a person, all images are wrong. Beethoven was one of the most romantic and sensitive composers. When you play these 32 sonatas, you feel exactly in which sonata his mood, when he was in love, when he was in a bad mood. You know, when he dedicated many of his sonatas to his girls, you feel how much in love, how much deepness and soul is in this music.
An excerpt from Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto, Rudolf Buchbinder conducting the Vienna Symphony Orchestra from the piano. That's from his latest CD featuring all five of Beethoven's piano concertos, recorded in one day in Vienna in 2003. In a program that also features Ginastera's Popol Vuh and Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, Buchbinder performs Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Slatkin, at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall this evening at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Ever since someone created the first ceramic cup or bowl, clay has been patted, molded, spun, painted, glazed, and fired into objects of utility and decoration. A contemporary center for this art thrives in Philadelphia's Old City, where an art studio and educational facility with international renown has nurtured ceramic artists for over three decades. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to the clay studio.
This is one of the sounds in the art of ceramics. Paul Moser, an associate artist at the clay studio in Philadelphia, is patting and turning a soft ball of clay as if he's getting ready to pitch, which, in a way, he is.
I'm trying to even out the clay and shape it so that when I throw it on the wheel, it will go on properly and I'll be able to throw what I want with it well.
How long do you have to do that?
As long as it's necessary to get it shaped the way you want and get it the evenness that you want.
One of the things we learn is that ceramics is not for the impatient. The clay studio, which today includes a shop, galleries, studio space, and classrooms for artists and students, is one of Philadelphia's late 20th century pioneers, formed in 1974 by five ceramic artists who needed a space to work. They found it on Oriana Street in Philadelphia's Old City neighborhood, says Clay Studio Executive Director Amy Sarner-Williams. She first joined the cooperative as an artist in 1975.
It was an historic neighborhood with all those historic sites, but very few residents at all, and a lot of empty buildings.
But the buildings were affordable and spacious enough to create the three-dimensional artwork. Ceramics has always been an art in a category all its own. Today it includes objects of utility, like pottery, cups, and dishware, as well as purely aesthetic forms like sculpture and installation art. The common element is clay, a material adaptable to various incarnations, all of which are celebrated at the Clay Studio, says artistic director Jeff Guido.
For us, a teapot is as valid as a conceptually based installation-oriented work. 1 month you could come here and see a Yixing teapot exhibition. The next month you can come here and see a video installation.
Video installation?
It would include some ceramic element in it. What we're finding is that younger artists today use a variety of different materials. One of my favorite pieces was videotaping the falling and breaking of a teacup.
Like the art form it represents, the clay studio itself has evolved through a combination of creativity, passion, and a bit of luck. By 1979, the cooperative, then 18 artists strong, had moved to Art Street and become a nonprofit with regular exhibitions and classes. The next year, after a fire from a faulty gas heater devastated the building, along came an insurance adjuster who just happened to love art.
His name was Bert Horowitz. He took us under his wing, and Bert became the first chair of our board of directors.
Through the 80s, the studio rented space down the street from where it is now, on 2nd Street between Alfred's Alley and Fireman's Hall. There are actually two addresses side by side. One door, for the public, leads to a shop where light-colored walls show off colorful pottery, dishware, and jewelry by artists from all over North America. Off the retail area are several gallery spaces with rotating monthly exhibitions. The other door, for the artists, opens to a space quite different, a glittering mosaic passageway, a site-specific work of art by Philadelphia muralist Isaiah Zagar. It continues up all four floors of the stairwell, with assorted three-dimensional pieces jutting from the walls, colorful figures, vessels, hand impressions, even a dog with wings. Some of the projections are from clay studio artists and students, including participants in the Claymobile program, started in 1992. Claymobile was based on the idea that for kids and other groups who couldn't come to the studio, the studio would come to them.
We have two vans which go out into the community and work with children and adults and provide them an opportunity to work with clay.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, or studio.
Are you about to put it on a wheel?
Well, you've moved ahead of me a bit.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to get to the point that I can do that. And I would like to have a number of pieces so I don't have to stop and do this between each one. I will have done it all.
The core mission of the Clay Studio is, as it's always been, to support artists. A juried panel selects a dozen resident artists from all over the country. They move to Philadelphia and for up to 5 years use the studios, teach, mount exhibitions, and make contacts in the community. An international component got started in the 80s, picking up steam in the early 90s with an exhibition of contemporary Eastern European ceramics, just after the wall came down.
In Eastern Europe at that time, there was a lot of political art being done, but because it was in ceramics and not real straightforward, the governments didn't realize it, so they didn't censor it as much.
Now, an international guest artist in residence often lives in an apartment across the street, rent-free, for 1 to 2 month periods. Finally, there are local associate artists like Paul Moser.
And the pieces will all be ready tomorrow morning to just go through and then make 5 putts.
But slapping, shaping, and even throwing are only the beginning. Pots, for example, may be fired once to get the water out, glazed, then fired again when the glaze color may change depending on the heating process. Clay Studio has both natural gas-fired kilns and electric. Artist Jennifer Martin says the gas kiln firing process alone can last 5 days.
A good 12 hours to load the kiln. And then when you come in the next morning, you start your actual firing. When you've reached the temperature that you desire, then you shut the kiln off. And then it cools for 2 days, and then we'll unload.
Unloading the kiln, says Williams, always brings some surprises.
There's always some things that came out better than you thought and some things that didn't come out as well.
But the surprise, the wonder, is part of the allure. Whatever draws people to this art form, the tactile quality of the work, the connection to history, the communal nature of the firing process, or the suspense that builds as the kiln door is about to open, there is clearly something addicting in this age-old, ever-new, highly personal expression, whether in a pot, a pendant, or a sculpture yet to be imagined.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Bird, homage to Brancusi, is at the Clay Studio through April 20th. This Friday, two new exhibitions open. Speaking Low, Surfaces in Earthenware looks at works created in a low fire process. In Maren Kloppman, New York, the artist relates architectural principles to ceramic designs. Both of these shows run through April 27th. Nina Jablonski, the head of anthropology at Penn State University, boasts quite the interesting resume. She's a paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, and primatologist who, for over a decade, has been immersed in the study of the evolution, biology, and social function of a most beguiling and provocative subject matter, the human skin. Though she isn't examining it in the way your dermatologist or cosmetologist might, her 2006 book Skin, A Natural History, tells the fascinating story of how our skin came to be in all its glorious naked beauty. Dr. Jablonski will be at the Wagner Free Institute of Science in Philadelphia this afternoon to discuss her book and research in a free lecture entitled The Evolution of Human Skin Color. And when I spoke with Nina Jablonski on the line from Penn State University, I first asked her what, during her many years of research, was the most surprising or revealing thing she'd learned about the human skin.
I think what I really gained an appreciation of was the fact that the skin is truly a biographical statement about a person. From a person's skin, we can apprehend so much about what they have gone through in life and what they want to say to the world. There are some things, of course, that the skin says about us over which we have no control. Our skin tells us that we've been in some fights. We might have some scars, some wrinkles. Our skin color indicates the nature of our ancestry. But there are so many other things that we as humans do to our skin to try to augment its appearance. We can add cosmetics or body paints or tattoo it or pierce it to make some kind of statement about our identity or our aspirations. It's just an amazingly informative organ. From looking at someone's skin, and even without thinking about it, we gain so much information about them. So I think that was my major revelation after all of these years.
And going back in history, I'm guessing besides the walls of caves, the skin was probably the first place where we practiced decorative arts.
Humans have probably been decorating themselves, their surfaces, for thousands, tens of thousands of years, using natural pigments like red ochre. And we know from looking at the historic records of the ancient Egyptians that they had a veritable cosmetics industry by 4,000 years ago, with lots of ground minerals that they were using for self-decoration. And so I would think we've been doing this, and we've been doing this in multiple different types of ways for thousands and thousands of years.
It's very difficult to talk about skin and skin color without talking about race issues. How are those covered in the book?
Well, I deal in a very forthright way about the evolution of skin and how our skin color is thought to have evolved based on a variety of different anatomical, physiological, and genetic evidence that we now have at hand. And I think one of the beautiful things that comes out of our research in this book is that we can understand something like the evolution of skin color really in a quite straightforward way these days. We have a lot of data that help us understand this. And we understand the physical forces that led to the evolution of skin color, namely that levels of ultraviolet radiation on the Earth's surface led to our having various levels of pigment in our skin depending on where our ancestors evolved. And so that makes complete evolutionary sense. And I think it's a really, really useful thing for people to know.
Going forward, and you're speaking to somebody who has, and I'll do the old joke about Irish skin, that we're not white, we're blue, we need 3 days in the sun to become white. As humans evolve, isn't there something genetically that states that dark is dominant? Do you predict that we're all going to become darker as we evolve?
Well, what is happening now in human history is an almost unprecedented level of movement of people over great distances. And this often involves people with very light pigmentation moving into areas close to the equator in areas previously occupied and inhabited by people with darkly colored skin, and just the opposite, people with darkly pigmented skin moving to dramatically far away from the land of their forebears and going into areas in previously only inhabited by people with lightly pigmented skin. Now, what happens when you get these populations together, especially in modern urban centers, is they get together, they share the same culture, they become friends, they have children together, and you end up, especially in the world's major urban centers today, having people who are various shades of tawny and brown, representing this marvelous admixture of populations that has really catapulted people together in the last few hundreds of years. So I don't think the whole world, in a sense, will be turning brown, but certainly the major metropolitan areas will be, just as a result of this really tumultuous and fantastic admixture of people coming into the major urban centers.
Nina Jablonski. She's this year's guest speaker in the Westbrook Lecture at the Wagner Free Institute of Science at 1700 West Montgomery Avenue in North Philadelphia this afternoon at 1. Our subject, the evolution of human skin color. Stars start somewhere, many of them at the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia, like Joyce DiDonato, who left 12 years ago and comes back an international star mezzo-soprano tomorrow when she sings a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society recital. However, Joyce DiDonato was not one of AVA's most likely to succeed. Her rise took rather longer, as she told Philadelphia Inquirer classical music critic David Patrick Stearns before a Lincoln Center recital on Wednesday.
Joyce DiDonato in her signature aria, Una Voce Poca Fa, from The Barber of Seville. She sung it all over the world, here in a performance at the Paris Opera. She's a major star in Europe, but Philadelphians with good memory know her as Dorabella in Così Fan Tutte at the Academy of Vocal Arts, where she spent 3 years. Music director Christopher Makatsouris particularly recalls how hard she worked, not just on her singing, but on a dance she did in Hansel and Gretel.
I remember her. Her disposition was strong, worked hard, worked constantly, even at that dance, that silly little dance. It wasn't silly to her. She would work hours to perfect the steps.
That's not the first thing that came bubbling up from Joyce DiDonato's mind when I caught her on Wednesday in her dressing room. She remembers living down the street from a wild gay bar and learning vocal techniques that haven't stopped working.
That's so funny what other people remember and what I have no recollection of that. I have recollection of the production, which was very sweet. I remember that. But, you know, he's such a tough maestro. And thank God, because by working a little bit with him, the Così Fan Tutte was the one show I did with him. And he came down at intermission and he said, "This is the worst thing I've ever seen." I thought, okay, I better step up and make the second act good. But, you know, I still have his face and his mouth and his fire coming in my imagination. I can close my eyes and I can see it. And it's like, no, it's not colorful enough. It's not communicative enough. And that has stayed with me, and that has been a gift.
Yet the road out of Philadelphia for Joyce DiDonato wasn't directly to the Metropolitan Opera, but was more like the road to vocal ruin. She knew how to work hard, but needed to learn how to sing smart. After she left AVA, she was accepted into a young artist program at the Houston Grand Opera and found out from voice teacher Steve Smith what had probably been holding her back. She was singing in ways that could soon wear out her voice.
That first lesson in Houston said, "You've got about 5 years left if you keep singing this way, because you're singing on youth and muscle." And I think I was just old enough to realize that he was really correct. And I knew I had to retool. I have to say, if that hadn't have happened, I'm going to predict that his prediction would have come true. He got me to strip away everything else and go back to the breath.
Now her vocal technique has such precision that her trill, in particular, is the envy of the industry, admired not just by Christopher Makatsouras, but by the late Beverly Sills, obviously someone greatly admired by DiDonato. A more subtle strength, however, is that DiDonato sings this kind of music with a kind of detail and meaning not often heard outside of intimate song recitals. She gives the vocal fireworks a soul, and in recitals, more abstract songs that need no coloratura take on a kind of character and backstory you associate with the operatic stage. Joyce DiDonato has the distinctive ability to give songs a face. Thanks to the different dimensions she brings to her music, DiDonato is doing some extremely sophisticated work with some of Europe's great opera directors. One of them is the remarkable Luc Bondy, who took her to the depths of madness in Handel's Hercules. And we're not talking about stylized operatic madness. Handel himself had extended breakdowns and captured them in ways that took DiDonato to the edge.
It was intense. I think I was a little difficult to live with. My husband was like, what is going on? I was like, nothing, why? It was so brilliantly realized on the paper, that incessant repetition and the ticks and the quirks that came. And Luc just pushed me and pulled it out of me and said, yes, more. And so I went really far. See the snake whips they burn.
Sophistication, however desirable, isn't what DiDonato is ultimately going for.
If I dare open up my mouth on stage, I better know what it is I want to say. Or, you know, and I may not always succeed, or I may go too far or not far enough, but the majority of it actually was personal work. I want to communicate, and I want to clear away the BS so that the line to the audience is direct and, yeah, intense, hopefully.
Joyce DiDonato from Aaron Copland's 12 Poems of Emily Dickinson. These will be featured in a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society recital at 3 tomorrow afternoon at the Independent Seaport Museum. David Patrick Stearns writes about Joyce DiDonato in tomorrow's Philadelphia Inquirer. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Zavit Schlank and myself. But thanks also this week to Mike Donohoe, Philip Wilder, Christina Jensen, and Lauren Zalot. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.